Oh, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 30th, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Paul Contino. Today's session number is 98-4, and it is titled Images of St. Francis of Assisi. Let's listen.
I see some familiar faces and some new faces. Hi, I'm glad you're here. And what I did on the board was just put some names on the board. Christ, St. Francis, and Dante and Giotto. And that's an awful lot to talk about in about an hour. And we are beginning now. I'm sending that message out to the tape players. We've been talking this week, some of you have been here earlier, about attention. Simone Weil, in her essay on school studies, says that if we read difficult poetry, maybe like Dante's, which is some of our difficult poetry I know, because of all of its references. Have you already gotten a sense of that just by dipping into a little bit, a few lines? That attention can carry over into our attention to others who are in affliction or in pain and just want our attention, and also to God in prayer. On Tuesday, we talked about the way in which icons, with their call to be silent and still, sort of like Elijah when he's listening for God, can also mediate that attentiveness to God, that intimacy with God, that an icon like this one, for example, especially seems to image for a lot of us, with the penetrating gaze that Christ shows there. Yesterday we talked about a very flawed, kind of bumbling guy whose body is covered with tattoos, who gets a tattooed image of Christ on his back, in part to please his wife, in part following some kind of mysterious command, which he knows he ought not disobey. His name is Parker. He's in a story called Parker's Back, and if you're interested in reading it, I can let you know where to find it. But today we're talking about another man named St. Francis, who lived his life to conform with Christ's. And if you look at this painting by Cimabue, which is in Assisi, you see the wounds in his hands, Christ's wounds in his hands and feet and his side appeared in a mystical moment on Francis's body. He was the first one in recorded history to bear the stigmata, and he lived his life to conform with Christ. I'm going to move over here because I can control the slides from here, and I may, from time to time, want to glance at my notes. This is Assisi. Have any of you been to Assisi before? Okay, yes. What's it like?
Long ago.
That is a vague memory, Barbara, yeah. Anybody else? It's a kind of place, I was there 6 years ago with my wife, that it just seems, maybe like holding, to have a quality of peace, quality of spirit that's palpable. If the place seems different, somehow Francis left Assisi a better place than it was. He was born here in 1182 to a pretty wealthy merchant family. He was baptized with the name Giovanni di Brandone. His father liked France, they say, so his name became Francis. He was a fairly rich guy. He thought he was going to become a knight. He loved stories of troubadours and knights. That's what he thought he was called to be. And his story, in many ways, is a story of gradual conversion. Gradually, he comes to an awareness that Christ has something else in mind for him. And the form that takes for Francis is poverty. Christ knew poverty. Francis saw that poverty was the way in which he would best be able to embody his imitation of Christ's life. And you can't get it so much in this picture, but if you were in that church that's right there on the top and looking out, you would see the beautiful countryside where Assisi is situated. And what Francis is especially known for is his embrace of the natural world. And you probably all know a prayer that I'm going to just be part of. If I can just put my finger on it, this book is a little bit difficult to work with. It's the Canticle to Brother Sun, and he praises God as God is seen in the sun, in the moon, in the wind. Most high, all powerful, all good Lord, all praise is yours, all glory, all honor, all blessing. To you alone, Most High, do they belong. No mortal lips are worthy to pronounce your name. All praise be yours, my Lord, for all that you have made. And first, my Lord, Brother Sun, who brings the day and light you give to us through him. Of you, Most High, he bears the likeness. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sisters, moon, and stars. In the heavens you have made them bright and precious and fair. All praise be yours, my Lord, through brother wind and air, all fair and stormy, all the weather's moods by which you cherish all that you have made. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister water, so useful, lowly, precious, and pure. All praise be yours, my Lord, through brother fire, through whom you brighten up the night. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister earth, our mother, who feeds us in her sovereignty and produces various fruits with colored flowers and herbs. All praise be yours, my Lord, through those who grant pardon for love of you, through those who endure sickness and trial, happy those who endure in peace. By you, Most High, they will be crowned. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister death. And when he died, he said to his body, brother donkey, he called his body, forgive me for all that I've put you through. He was blind at that point. He was sick. And he was somebody who, though he affirmed the body and the natural world, was also someone who was an ascetic, who embraced physical suffering in order to be closer to Christ's suffering. And many would say, I'm not sure we could take a poll in this room, who is the person most like Christ since Christ died? Yaroslav Pelikan, from whom I've learned much, would say most likely the answer would be Francis of Assisi. And it cuts across denominational lines. This isn't just Catholics. Francis is a kind of ecumenical saint. He appeals to so many for his embrace of poverty and his love of the natural world. This love of the natural world and the individual religious experience that Francis has is so important to Giotto, the painter, who breaks with the icon tradition, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and Dante, the poet, who writes a poem that intensely shows the development and conversion of a person, Dante, as he moves through hell, purgatory, and heaven. Very influential on both of these figures who live in the century after. But first, let's talk about Giotto just briefly. This is Giotto's Madonna. And what a different image of the Madonna, I think you'd agree. I'm sorry, the face isn't showing. If you look at the face, you'd see her hair isn't showing. It's an icon because it's filled with gold. This is the timeless realm where the body is transfigured, as it ought to be, right? We're called to be in the image and likeness of God. The icon gives us a window to that. Giotto says, yes, we are called to be the image and likeness of God, but look at the bodies that we have right now. Aren't they good? Just as Brother Wind, the sun and the moon are good, our bodies are good. And so you can see, if you look closely, Mary's lips are open a bit. You can see clearly her bosom beneath her clothes. She's embodied. There's a fullness, a solidity in the figure, which is a complete break. One of the crucial breaks from the icon tradition, why the West in its religious art goes in a very, very different direction than Eastern Orthodoxy. If the icon also suggests Are there any other seats? There's some seats up here, if you'd like. Hi, Roberta. There's some seats right here. Maybe we can squeeze one in here.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I should say before I begin all this about the natural world that Fulbert is here, and Fulbert knows more about Francis than I, and we had the nice occasion this morning to take a walk, a hike to Hart Lake, which I thought was going to be the best of walk preparation for this kind of a presentation. Francis was known for things like taming wild wolves, you know, the wolf of Gubbio, and you could get him to calm down. We didn't have any encounters with any bears. Where we had to talk like Francis, but it was so good to talk about Francis with Fulbert this morning, and I've learned from him in the few days that I've been here with him, as well as Roberta, and so many of you too. Anyway, the timeless realm of the icon. In Giotto's Arena Chapel, which is in Padua, Italy, what happens is we don't so much enter the timeless realm of the kingdom, we start entering time. We enter the events of Christ's life, step by step. So, Christ's life beginning with the Annunciation, the word of Gabriel kind of carried over this arch. The church is dedicated to Mary of the Annunciation. And if you can recall Vespers last night and those powerful words that Mary speaks, "Let it be done to me according to your word," that I think Giotto, again, if you could look more closely, more vividly, captures the dignity and the humility of Mary as she stands accepting that role. But we move on from there. We move to concrete events in Jesus' life, like the visitation of the Magi. It's not an icon. Now, I should say that icons do image events in the New Testament. You know, it's not as if it's only that frontal one-to-one. But there is a sense in which Giotto is trying to capture a kind of realism of the natural world. And you see it again in the bodies that you can tell are underneath those robes. I like this image too because Francis so loved the Feast of the Nativity. He called it the Feast of Feasts. And he, I think he was one of the first, I might be wrong, erected a creche, you know, and a manger. Much like this, with the figures representing Jesus, the poor king of Bethlehem. In some of the stories of Francis, like the little flowers of St. Francis, there's a figure like Judas. Here is the dramatic moment in which Judas kisses Christ, and you can see how Giotto is accentuating the drama of the moment. With those sticks that are all above their right and leading your focus right to that face-to-face encounter between the betrayer and Christ. And in the little flowers, the betrayer, I'm only part of the way through this book, but seems to be a man named Elias who's up to some devious things. So that the hagiographers of France, so those who told his life story, would draw on Christ's life and find parallels between the two. Francis spoke of a vision he had of the cross. And in this vision of the cross, he seemed to hear Christ say to him, "Take up your cross." And I think the way we can understand things like stories that he put ashes in his food, you know, we might, and I wish I could have heard you on the crucifixion today. I was kind of getting ready for this, but the idea to be closer to Christ in the union with his suffering. And so he lived his life in order to be close to Christ in Christ's suffering. Here, I mean, there's so much to say about this painting, just Giotto's naturalism again. And if you look at the angels, people say you can almost hear them crying with different expressions on their faces. You see Mary in grief being taken away by John, Mary Magdalene, I believe, embracing the feet of Christ, the tunic, Nicodemus. And here the Lamentation, one of the most famous images. Have any of you seen this image before? Is it familiar to you? Some of you I see nodding. Notice the way the gestures are subtly different from each other. figures like this. John, kind of symbolism here, who's represented as an eagle, almost with his hands and his arms, like an eagle. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea quietly breathing to the side. And this woman with their backs to us, as if drawing us into the picture. We're being drawn into time, not the eternal, atemporal, timeless realm, but the time of Christ's burial and the lamentation of his friends. So again, an embrace of this world, the natural world, the embodied, resurrected Christ saying to Mary, do not touch me, no ame to Jerry, do not touch me before I rise to the Father in the resurrection. Now we turn to Francis himself. And this is a scene probably not painted by Giotto. Some still say, yes, Giotto painted those frescoes, painted around 1300 in Assisi. Some say it was the school of Giotto. Some say it was people who maybe knew what Giotto was doing but worked to something else. In fact, there's some recent scholarly controversy about this. But this is the moment in which Francis is taken to court by his dad. He sold his father's goods. He's been doing this now for a while. If a beggar passes him and he lets him go by, then he feels terrible about it. He runs back and he gives, you know, whatever he can to the beggar. His father takes him to court, to the bishop's court, and demands, you know, what he's taken. And much to his amazement, Francis takes off all of his clothes and gives everything. The bishop, who's moved by this gesture, tries to clothe Francis is standing there naked. And people are kind of flabbergasted. And this creates quite an uproar in the town, you can imagine. And later on, there's a second order of Franciscans that are formed by Claire, who is Francis's dear close friend. And she's just a little girl at the time, and she's catching wind of this. If you'd love to read some reflections and stories, there's a great book in the library called The Francis Book, which I just dipped into. I'll leave it in the library. It's got all kinds of reflections on Francis and stories, and it's really, really quite good. And the bookstore has a copy of this nice little book, The Wisdom of St. Francis, which I'll read from again in a moment. So this is the pivotal moment where he embraces poverty fully, but it's been leading up to this moment for a while. This is an interesting painting. The man on the right is the Pope, Innocent III, who's very powerful. He's one of the good ones. He's wise, he's good-hearted, and around 1209, Francis, who has embraced poverty, goes to him and says, I want you to sanction us as an order. There's not that many of them. Within 12 years, there's 3,000. But I want you to give us, the institutional okay. And what I like about this, I was thinking of the forum, and how do you reconcile intense spiritual experience, individual spiritual experience, and the institution. And this, maybe this painting captures something of it. Because here he goes to the institution and wants sanction, as if you could have both, that you can bring both together. What happens is, Innocent hears Francis out. He's moved by Francis' sanction. But he's got counselors who say, look, this guy could be a heretic. This is trouble. All this poverty talk, you don't like it. Innocent goes to sleep. And in his dream, he's dressed with his mitre, his bishop's mitre, his elegant robe, and he dreams that Francis is holding up a toppling building. And the toppling building is San Giovanni Laterano, St. John Lateran in Rome, the Pope's church, and it's about to topple. And who's holding it up? It's not the Pope. It's Francis. And he wakes up and he says, Francis, you've got it. Give me the oral okay, give me the thumbs up. And, became written, and his successor, as we'll read in Dante, also said, okay, Francis. Now this is one of the great, what's missing? Are the birds. See, I don't know if this will go down. Okay. All right, that's better. And this is where I will, can you all see the little birds there? And Francis. No. This little book has excerpts from different lives of Francis, including one by St. Bonaventure. Be my guest.
Did I hit forward or back?
Yeah, I can do it up here. There's Francis, okay, giving up his clothes. He's in the third. Here we are. Okay. I think the birds are comfortable. I don't think they like books. I think that's good. Everybody on this side can see the birds, right?
Yeah.
Everybody on this side can barely see the birds, but trust me, they're there. They're different colored, and they're all kind of looking up at Francis. And this is the story by Bonaventure. When he was near Bavegna, he came to a huge flock of birds of various kinds. He ran to them and greeted them, and they all turned towards him and waited for him. Those that had perched on the bushes bent their heads and looked at him in an extraordinary way. He appealed to them to hear the word of God, saying, "My brothers, you have a great obligation to praise your Creator. He clothed you with feathers and gave you wings to fly, appointing the clear air as your home, and he looks after you without any effort on your part. The birds showed their pleasure in a wonderful fashion. They stretched out their necks and flapped their wings, gazing at him with their beaks open. In his spiritual enthusiasm, Francis walked among them, brushing them with his habit, and not one of them moved until he made the sign of the cross and gave them permission to go. Then they all flew away together with his blessing." And when you go to Assisi, I hope you all get a chance to do this, you walk in right in the front door, and then you look out, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the birds are here on the right side, and this next image, the miracle of the spring, which I don't know the story to, but Fulbert might, is on the left, and then the whole Assisi countryside is outside. You see these two images of nature, sacramental nature, and then all before you, Assisi. It's just a very, very beautiful image. Do you know this? Well, what's going on here, Fulbert?
It's a stigmatization.
I don't think it's the stigmatization. It's called the miracle of the spring, and he's holding his hands out. Yeah, because you were talking about the spring before, where he sees Clara in the spring, but not this one. It looks like he's drinking. So maybe it's like the Exodus story where there was thirst and the water came out of the rock. Francis was a healer. You don't have to change it. This one's okay. He's exorcising the devils from the town here. There are stories of that. And this is actually one of the ways in which the stigmata is represented in Giotto. It's being confirmed here. Giotto is portraying Francis dead, and they are confirming the wounds in his hands and his feet and his side. And we'll see some more, we'll see some later imagings of the stigmata, which are very powerful in a moment. But this is a painting which I like very much. In the Bardi Chapel in Florence, the death of Francis. And those gestures of mourning that we saw in the Lamentation of Christ show up again here. Again, suggesting some of those parallels. I mentioned the later paintings. This is Siseta, okay, in the 14th century. The image of Francis giving up his clothing there, perhaps to his father. And this is Bellini in the 15th century. This is, I think, the reception of the stigmata. In this image, Francis is standing with great dignity while his hands are extended. And again, the great detail of the natural landscape, which art historians will say Francis in part makes possible. He's so influential on his age that without Giotto, you don't have a Renaissance, and here you're beginning to get into Renaissance painting with all of its close appreciation of the natural world. So too in Northern European painting, Van Eyck. And here you see a seraphim and Christ crucified appearing, and here Francis is kneeling. One thing my students and I talked about a little bit when we talked about this canto from Dante is, you know, how would you imagine Francis receiving the stigmata? Would he be kneeling with a kind of humility? Would he be standing? It's interesting to think about the gestures that we bring to prayer. Jürgen Moltmann has written about this in a recent book about various gestures. But I'm going to turn now. Maybe after I'll pause. Are there any comments on these images of Francis, these pictorial images, that you'd like to share before I move to Dante? Okay, then we'll make our way from image to word by turning to Dante. This is Botticelli's portrait of the kind of stern-looking Dante, yes? Free association. I say Dante. Dante, what do you think?
Hell.
Okay, hell, right? I mean, today at the announcements, you know, Inferno. Dante's Inferno. And if that's all you read, you miss a tremendous amount. Yes, he did write the Inferno, and it's grim and troubling. But he writes it because it's only one third of the journey. He's on a journey of conversion. He's a guy who gets himself into a lot of trouble. He lived in Florence, he was involved in politics, he was exiled, mostly on trumped-up charges. But early in his life, met a woman named Beatrice. He met her when he was a child, but he meets her again on the street, and I imagine in this painting by Rossetti, she's the woman in blue, because the other two kind of seem involved in their own activity. The woman in blue seems to be looking at Dante, and there's a kind of gaze that Dante and Beatrice share is so important. They don't marry. They marry different people. She dies rather young. He never forgets her. He writes a book called The New Life, which describes the effect that her goodness, the way in which she became for him a kind of image of Christ, the effect she had on him. But he goes astray. And,
well,
yes?
Are the other two women symbolic of his potentially going astray? Or
they might be, but I have to reread The New Life because I forget exactly. There's another woman who kind of represents philosophy after Beatrice dies, draws him away to, well, some would read it as a kind of a romantic affair. Some would read it as a kind of moving away from theology to philosophy. The women are symbolic. The neat thing about Dante is, though, they're not allegories. That is, they're real historical women. Beatrice was a real woman that lived in Florence, and she's very much a figure, a mediator of grace in the Divine Comedy, which is imaged here, the Divine Comedy, which takes Dante to hell, to the mountain, the seven levels of purgatory, where there's a purgation, a confession and a purgation of sin. At the top here, you see Adam and Eve, because that's the earthly paradise, all the way at the top of this mountain. And then this starry realm up here that he is drawn into, that's what we're going to be reading. He's passed into the moon, into Mars, Venus, and now he's in the sun, the sphere of the sun, and the heavenly Jerusalem, paradise. What's at the heart of Dante? Not hell, love, I would argue. The dead center, the live center of the comedy, is a meditation on love in the middle of purgatory. At the end of the Divine Comedy, Dante's will is moved by the love that moves the sun and the other stars. You see the stars, what keeps it all together? Love, capital L, God's grace. And that's where Dante is far away from in the beginning of the poem. The library has the Divine Comedy translated by Sayers. Anybody's been here for a while, and I would surely recommend it. But you know, let me just read the beginning of the poem. Here's Dante. He's going through a severe midlife crisis. Midway, this way of life, we're bound upon. I woke to find myself in a dark wood, where the right road was wholly lost and gone. Ah me, how hard to speak of it, that rude and rough and stubborn forest. The mere breath of memory stirs the old fear and blood What he tries to do is get out of it by climbing a mountain, sort of like Coleman way. He's going to climb this craggy mountain. He doesn't run into a bear. He runs into three other creatures that block his way, a lion, a fox, and a wolf. And he can't do it by himself. He needs a guide. The guide is Virgil, the great epic poet of Rome, writer of the Aeneid. Virgil takes him down through hell. Virgil takes him, guides him through the levels of purgatory, but at the top of purgatory, he meets Beatrice, and he confesses, I went wrong. I went after women when I oughtn't have, that I shouldn't have. He confesses all of that, and he bathes afterwards. And this is when he's bathing in the River of the Knowing, where he's kind of restored to a sense of integrity as Beatrice, other women look on. And I'm really going ahead now to the very end of the poem, the mystical vision rendered here by Gustave Doré, where he sees the heart of the universe, love. He sees the Trinity. He sees the Incarnation. He sees the whole church gathered in circles. Circles and light play such an important role in paradise, and the way words fail. And words ultimately fail, Dante, but that's something we can talk about in Canto 33 on Saturday. For now, let's turn from images to words, and let's see. I think that I can read Canto 11 in about 10 minutes and comment on it, which will give us about 15 minutes to talk a bit about it. And I guess what I'd like to talk about is what surprises you in the poem, what most interests you in this poem. How does Francis, as he's rendered by Dante here, speak to us in our lives? And if you're sitting and you don't have a copy of the poem, maybe you could find someone who does. There's like 25 of them going around. Maybe you could share with somebody. But it's easier to look at it, you know, while you're reading along, because it gets kind of dense. And I'm going to pause at places to explain what's going on. Okay, so they're in the fourth sphere of the sun. And Dante has just seen 12 lights dance for him. These are all great saints of the church, teachers of the church. One of them, thanks, is St. Thomas Aquinas. And St. Thomas Aquinas is from the Dominican order, but he's going to tell the story of Francis in this gesture of generosity. Everybody is so courteous in heaven, and everybody smiles. They don't laugh. We talked about this with us. They don't laugh. They don't have an outburst of, releasing a kind of passion, but they smile in the most inviting way. Aquinas does this and generously talks about the founder of the Franciscans, St. Francis. But first, Dante, as he sometimes do, kind of looks down on earth and says, what vanity, you know, you're up to all the wrong things. And then Thomas is going to come over, and first I'll begin with Dante's thoughts. Oh, senseless strivings of the mortal round, how worthless is that exercise of reason that makes you beat your wings into the ground. One man was giving himself to law, one to aphorisms, one sought sinecures, and one to rule by force or sly persuasion. One planned his business, one his robberies. One tangled in the pleasures of the flesh, wore himself out, and one lounged at his ease. Well, I, of all such vanities relieved, high in heaven with my Beatrice, arose to glory, glorious and received. Just a word. This isn't cheap grace, right? He's passed through hell. It's wretched. He's gone through purgatory. He's bent down with the proud. He's passed through the fire of the lustful. He's confessed. It's not been an easy trip for Dante. So by the time he gets to this point, he shouldn't sound self-satisfied here. He's really, through grace, come a long way. So now he turns to those stars that are dancing. When each had danced his circuit and come back to the same point of the circle, all stood still like votive candles glowing in a rack. And I saw the splendor of the blazing ray that had already spoken to me, smile, and smiling quickened. And I heard it say, here's St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas is going to say, I know you're wondering about what I said a while ago. I'm going to make it all clear right now. Just as I take my shining from on high, says Aquinas, so I look into the primal source. I see which way your thoughts have turned and why. You're uncertain, and would have me find open and level words in which to speak what I expressed too steeply from your mind. When I said leads to where all plenty is, and no mortal ever rose to equal this one, and it is well to be exact in this. This is where we have to start paying attention. This is where you can start getting into Francis. The providence that governs all mankind with wisdom so profound that any creature who seeks to plumb it might as well be blind, in order that the bride seek her glad good, and the sweet groom who crying from on high took her in marriage with his blessed blood, sent her two princes, one on either side, that she might be secure within herself, and therefore be more faithfully his bride. Who is the bridegroom here?
Christ.
Christ. Who is the bride?
The church.
The church. Who are the two princes? Don't expect you to know this. Francis is one of them. Dominic is the other. Dominic's story will be told by Bonaventure in the next canto. But now they're going to talk about Francis. Francis is the one in his love who shone like the seraphim. The other, Dominic, in his wisdom, walked the earth bathed in the splendor of the cherubim. I shall speak of only one, though to extol one or the other is to speak of both, in that their works led to a single goal. And now he sets the scene. Here's a scene. Between the Turpino and the little race, sprung from the hill blessed Ubaldo chose, a fertile slope spreads up the mountain's face. Perugia breathes its heat and cold from there. Through Porta Sole and Lucera and Gualdo, behind it mourn the heavy yoke they bear. From it, at that point where the mountainside grows least abrupt, a sun rose to the world. As this one does at times from Ganges' tide, therefore let no man speaking of that place call it Assisi, I have risen, but rather Orienti, so to speak with proper grace. What's going on? In the Ganges, people thought, the sun shone brighter. I feel here at Holden the sun shines brighter. You seem to be closer, it's more powerful. That's what people thought about the Ganges in India. What does Orienti mean? Orienti means a sun has risen, okay? Sun, you know, if we pre-associate it with that word, we might come up with Christ. Christ, the Son of God, sometimes the sun used as an image of Christ, right? And so if the sun has risen in Assisi, again, this notion that here's Francis in conformity with the sun, with Christ, okay? Another sun rising. Nor was he yet far distant from his birth. Well, actually, he's about 24. Okay, what he's talking about here. When the first comfort of his glorious powers began to make its warmth felt on the earth. A boy yet, 24. For that lady, now he's going to talk about a marriage. What kind of marriage is this? For that lady who, like death, knocks on no door that opens to her gladly, he had to battle his own father's wrath. With all his soul, he married her before the diocesan court at Corum Patra, and day by day he grew to love her more. Bereft of her first groom, she had had to stand more than 11 centuries, scorned, obscured, until he came, Francis. No man had asked her hand. None at the news that she had stood beside the bed of Amyclus, and heard unruffled the voice by which the world was terrified. Amyclus was a Roman who was so content to be poor, he wasn't even frightened by Caesar's voice. But Amyclus isn't so important here. Amyclus is Athens, now we come to Jerusalem. None at word of her fierce constancy so great that even Mary stayed below. She climbed the cross to share Christ's agony. Well, we're all asking questions now. Who is she talking? Who is this she that climbed the cross? It's poverty. Christ was naked on the cross. But lest I seem obscure, speaking this way, take Francis and poverty to be those lovers. But in plain words is what I mean to say. Their harmony and tender exultation gave rise in love and awe and tender glances to holy thoughts and blissful meditation. She's an allegory. She's not a real person. And one commentator, Eric Auerbach, says, you know, it's funny that Dante doesn't use some vivid event like, you know, preaching to the birds or taming the wolf or the miracle of the spring. Why this vague marrying of an abstract figure? Because it's not about Francis and his charm. It's about Francis marrying poverty and Christ married, conforming his life to Christ. It's not about Francis's personality. It's about his conforming to Christ. But what happens? He becomes so charismatic, people want to follow him. And that's what happens in the stanzas that follow. So Francis and poverty marry. Their harmony and tender exaltation gave rise in love and awe and tender glances to holy thoughts and blissful meditation. The venerable Bernard, pretty wealthy guy, seeing them so, kicked off in shoes and towards so great a peace, ran and running seemed to go too slow. O wealth unknown, O plenitude untried, Egidius went unshod, unshod Sylvester, followed the groom, for so it pleased the bride. Thenceforth this father and this happy lord moved with his wife and with his family, already bound round by the humble cord. He didn't grieve because he had been born the son of Bernardoni. He didn't care that he went in rags, a figure of passing scorn. He went with regal dignity to reveal his stern intentions to Pope Innocent, from whom his order first received the seal. There, as more souls began to follow him in poverty, his wonder-working life, the better son among the seraphim, Honorius, the next pope, moved by the eternal breath, placed on the holy will of this chief shepherd a second crown and ever-flowing wreath. Then, with a martyr's passion, he went forth, Sicilian Crusades, and in the presence of the haughty sultan, he preached Christ and his brotherhood on earth. But when he found none there would take Christ's pardon, rather than waste his labors, he turned back to take the fruit of the Italian garden. And here's the stigmata. He fasts for 40 days, like Christ in the desert, on a mountain, on a crag. On the crag between Tiber and Arno Bend, in tears of love and joy, he took Christ's final seal, the holy wounds of which he wore 2 years. When God, whose loving will had sent him forward to work such good, was pleased to call him back to where the humble soul has its reward. He, to his brothers, as to rightful heirs, commended his dearest lady, and he bade them to love her faithfully for all their years. Then from her bosom that dear soul of grace willed to its return to its own blessed kingdom, and wished its flesh no other resting place, the earth, no brother earth. You would have no other place. Now, a shift here. I'm going to read this, and it's an important part of Paradiso. Things aren't what they used to be. And now, Dominic turns to the way in which Aquinas turns to the way in which the Dominican fold has become corrupt. And there's a kind of prophetic voice of denunciation here. Dante does it with the Pope, who is in power then. He does it with the orders. It will happen again with other orders. And so Aquinas says, think now what manner of man was fit to be his fellow helmsman, Dominic, holding Peter's ship straight to its course across the dangerous sea. Such was our patriarch. Hence, all who rise and follow his command will fill the hold, as you can see, with fruits of paradise. But his flock, Dominic's, has grown so greedy for the taste of new food that it can't help but be far scattered as it wanders through the waste. The more of his vagabond and distant sheep wander from him, the less milk they bring back when they return to the fold. A few do keep close to the shepherd, knowing what wolf howls in the dark around them, but they are so few it would take little cloth to make their cows. He's got some really good ones. And he's writing in the vernacular, too. He's writing in the common Italian, so they're coming through loud and clear. The monastic ideal isn't being lived up to here, and he's letting people know. Now if my words have not seemed choked and blind, if you have listened to me and taken heed, and if you will recall them to your mind, your wish will have been satisfied in part. For you will see how the good plan is broken, and what rebuke my words mean to your heart, when I referred a while back in our talk to where all plenty is and to bare rock. But let's turn our attention back to Francis and this evocation of the marriage. And as you heard this and listened to it, it's hard. It's the first time you're reading it, listening to it. What struck you? I'm just interested, sort of as we did yesterday with Parker's back, what details struck a chord with you and seemed either interesting, perplexing, surprising?
I think for me, the thing that struck most was the power of his example being passed through these other people. Bernard and Egidius, Sylvester, all of these names being familiar to the people that were reading.
Yes.
It's just that and the brevity of his life.
In his 40s, yes, when he dies at 45. The kind of charisma that he had, that people just saw something in him and followed and ran after him and left everything. This gospel call to have no copper or silver or gold in your pocket takes it literally, his followers do. No sandals, no staff, from Matthew. You remember? He lives that out. Any other details? Yes.
It isn't confusing, it's just a different style to go from what appears to be a historical narrative to allegory and then back and forth. You have to know the stuff to be able to tell which is which, is the way I see it.
Yeah. No, it is. It is kind of funny that he does that. And there's not too many places where he does use that allegory like that. And when I was reading Eric Auerbach, who writes on this canto, and this notion of using abstraction to de-emphasize Francis' personality, which turns out to be so powerful, to emphasize the conformity of Christ, this idea of the death to self, he'll lose himself, will find himself. That Francis' personality, which has its stamp on the next two centuries, is so strong by this this loss of self, and this marriage, and this allegorical poverty. And it is a back and forth in there in the poem. Other details, Roberta?
Yeah, the image of poverty climbing up on the cross, Jesus while Mary remains. It's just really strong.
And sensuous, bodily, and this willingness to embrace a kind of erotic image. I mean, Francis is naked, and there's a marriage here, and he's marrying poverty, and I think it's part of the age. I mean, again, it's an age, I think. I mean, on the one hand, I was reading that Francis would jump into Heart Lake if he felt sexual temptation, you know? I mean, he would jump into a very cold place on Heart Lake, but the nearest the Heart Lake in Assisi. But on the other hand, the goodness of the body and this use of love imagery to express this event. Other details. Fulbert, is there anything that you might point to here in Dante that?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Maybe an explanation. You have a slide deck that you said it was recognition of the stigmata.
Yes.
I don't understand that. Could you explain that a little bit?
I hope I do too. I think what it is. It reminds me, I'm thinking now parallel lives again, it reminds me of Thomas, let me feel the wounds, let me put my hand inside. He kept it hidden. I mean, he did not play this up. He kept the wounds hidden, apparently, during his life. Maybe Roberta will help me on this. But maybe what they're doing at the end there is confirming with the senses. Roberta?
I was only going to help by saying that a lot of Protestants aren't familiar with the notion of the stigmata at all.
Yeah. Right. And let me try that out. I got it. Let me read to you
Let me read to you what happens, okay? Okay, he's 40 days on the mountain. This is the first time anything like this happens in history. It's the feast, or near the feast of the Exaltation of the Cross, 14 September, and he has a vision. He beheld an angel, a seraph with six wings, and between the wings of the seraph, Francis suddenly descried the figure of the crucified Christ. He was overwhelmed by the vision, and then in the words of his biographer, Bonaventure, quote, "As the vision disappeared, it left his heart ablaze with eagerness and impressed upon his body a miraculous likeness. There and then, the marks of nails began to appear in his hands and feet, just as he had seen them in the vision of the man nailed to the cross. His hands and feet appeared pierced through the center with nails. His right side seemed as if he had been pierced with a lance and was marked with a livid scar which often bled." And apparently, according to Pelikan, for many, many years, a Protestant Lutheran, wonderful church historian, you know his work, Jaroslav Pelikan, History of Church Doctrine, Jesus Through the Centuries, Mary Through the Centuries. It's like a book every 6 months now. But in one, he says that, you know, this was confirmed by a lot of people. I mean, it would take a real hardened skeptic to say nothing happened. And then there have been these other cases since then, you know? Now, he also points out that followers of Mohammed have sometimes bore his wounds, you know, so who's to say which one is, why should one be more authentic than another? But, you know, there apparently are people who have these wounds, and I think the way it's understood with Francis is this notion of participation, this love of Christ, which is such an intense love that it desires the cross. It desires to participate, to share in, to conform to Christ by sharing in the suffering of the cross. And as I said, he kept it kind of hidden. What he thought was most important was poverty, keeping the rule of poverty, not owning anything, not keeping money. You know, that's what he wanted. You know, he didn't say to his followers, you know, you can have this too. No, but then at his death, it seems that it's being confirmed. That's how I understand that painting. Others? Things in the poem that struck you as interesting images?
What time is it? It's wonderful. The description of where he's from. He goes on for three paragraphs without mentioning Assisi. You know, it's always
Yeah, he's kind of indirect in that way. Yeah. That's true of other places in Dante. That's where the footnotes at the back help. You can't read Dante without footnotes. They really, really help. But if you take the time, it's wonderful. Because you learn history, you learn theology, you learn so much. It's just an encyclopedic kind of imagination that he had. He brings everything together that was sort of known in the 14th century and gives it to us in his poem. Yes?
Is the Bernard he speaks of here, the Saint Bernard,
It's not Bernard of Clairvaux.
Okay.
Bernard of Clairvaux is earlier.
Okay.
He was another figure who reformed monasticism. But this is a Bernard who was a close friend of Francis and follows him. I wonder if any of you are moved by the story and the images to somehow muse about ways in which Francis might speak to our time, our situation. Are there ways in which this saint speaks to us? Roberta is so good in her books in showing the way the early fathers and mothers of the church who went to the desert speak to our situation, our ordinary lives. And in practicing our faith, the essay Saying Yes and Saying No, Sean Copeland makes reference to Francis. Do you see Francis as someone who too intensely says no? No to, you know, having a nice shirt. No to nice food. No to the pleasures. I mean, are some of you saying this is a no-sayer? Too much?
I kind of see Mother Teresa picking up St. Francis had done, and her work was like she was poverty and helped the poor and tried to be more Christ-like. you know, doing things that Christ did.
Yeah.
You don't see very many people doing that.
So is that a saying no or a saying yes?
I'm saying no.
A saying no to?
To material things.
Yeah. Mother Teresa, that's a very apt comparison. There's a wonderful story about how he talks about, I was very turned off by lepers, he says. And then, like Mother Teresa, there's a way in which you can discover joy in extending compassion to afflicted people like that. And Francis did that. Yes?
I'm always drawn to the paradox of things, and that no is also yes.
Okay.
That in saying no, there's a discovery of the... I mean, the connection with the birds and things, and that
yeah.
you know, that it is, there isn't, it's not only a no, but
right.
it's a no and a yes.
Mm-hmm, yes.
What I heard you say is that even though he experienced denial of the flesh, he also celebrated the flesh. He didn't
yeah.
experience that great duality where he totally
no.
rejected that side.
No. His body is his brother. Yeah.
Very much an affirmation of Christ's life.
Yeah.
And in that, you know, an imitation that's so close that it becomes almost a challenge, almost to us to say, well, he could do that much.
This much.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing is, you know, he made allowances. Not everybody could become celibate. Lay people, a third order of Franciscans was formed. Right? So if there are lay Franciscans who do their best to live according to Franciscan rule in ordinary married life. And so he's wonderful in that way of kind of taking you where you are in that sense. And being inclusive with befriending Claire and then with the second order of women Franciscans.
But,
yeah, go ahead. Yes, good.
The poverty of Francis as an image of marriage Francis is poverty is a great note against the social situation of his time. It's quite interesting that the first biography of Francis is it's forbidden, it's taken away.
Ah.
The very critical biography is, for example, a little story is in this first biography that Francis was invited by a cardinal to a big dinner. And he came and all the dishes were full of wine and I don't know, meat and so on. And the principals came, the bishops came and so on. And Francis went to Trastevere, to the board of the poor people. And there he begged as he did it normally. And so he got a piece of hard bread and this and that. The meal of the poor. And
yes.
then he went to the cardinals and to the bishops and gave everybody something
wow.
of the poor. Mm-hmm. And this story ends and so could be compared the food of the bishop with the food of the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite interesting. Normally we take poverty as not directed against a real situation, but it's poverty against the new capitalism.
Yes,
Lombardian capitalism and so on.
Yeah.
It has a real enemy.
And a bite to it. Yes, yes. Oh, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful story. Paul?
Well, I really appreciate, first, obviously, Francis' love of the earth.
Yeah.
And the way he speaks that, but also the way he unites love of Christ and identity with Christ with the love of the earth. Because I think theologically, that is, we're so first article, second article, you know, the Trinity and the Creed make those distinctions that they can pull apart. Francis really pulls it together.
That's nice.
I think the parallel with Mother Teresa gives me an insight, perhaps, how the people then were enamored by this, as we today have been, crossing all church lines, crossing all religious lines, that the admiration for someone who believes something so strongly in terms of the poor and the suffering. I mean, we, as a world, she is a person. I know of no other who has drawn such attention. I suspect that must have been okay.
Yeah, and maybe still is in many ways with Francis, you know, for many. Well, let me see. I think that that is the time. And thanks so much for being here and being so present and for your comments. And enjoy the earth. Enjoy the day.